Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At this week's UN Summit on Hunger in Rome, the United States, Europe, and Japan came under fire for their alleged indifference to a world hunger crisis. All subsidized their own farmers at the expense, it's charged, of the third world. In this hour, why a new $100 billion subsidy for American farmers may mean dire consequences for the third world. We begin tonight in Pakistan, where today a suicide bomb attack outside the U.S. consulate in Karachi has left at least 11 dead and dozens injured in a massive blast that blew a 10-foot hole in the compound wall. The State Department is condemning the attacks and reevaluating how many American personnel to keep in Pakistan. The BBC's Susanna Price is in Karachi and has been working the story all day. I asked her if there's any word on who might be responsible.
Well, the police here say they're investigating and that they're keeping an open mind. There's one unknown group who has claimed responsibility. They sent a handwritten note to some newspapers here, but most people I've spoken to said they've never heard of this group and they're dismissive of the claim. It's very difficult to ascertain who could be responsible. There are a large number of Islamic militants and extremists here in Pakistan. Some of them are veteran fighters from Kashmir. Others have fought with the Taliban. Many of them oppose America's policies in Afghanistan, fighting against al-Qaeda. And they're also openly angry about American policy in the Middle East. And, of course, another suggestion is that it's actually al-Qaeda themselves who carried out this attack. This is unusual to see these suicide car bombings in Pakistan. We had the first one last month. This is the second one. It does suggest a change of tactics, and it could be the members of al-Qaeda coming out from Afghanistan are bringing these kind of tactics to Pakistan.
What was the response today, Susanna, from the Pakistani government?
Well, they expressed their condolences to the families of those bereaved. They said they believe those behind the attacks were trying to cause instability in the country. They suggested that possibly the Indians could be behind this attack, but again said that there were various others who could be. Basically, I think Pakistan wants to use this kind of attack to suggest that far from exporting terrorism, as it feels many countries still suggest, it itself is the victim of terrorism, and that people should notice this, that it has been trying to curb militancy, and instead those militants have maybe turned back on the Pakistan government and are carrying out attacks on America, which is, of course, Pakistan's ally at the moment.
Is there a sense that Pakistan's government is beleaguered, is being knocked off balance by this drumbeat of attacks, or does it appear to be fairly solidly in place?
Well, I don't think it'll be knocked off balance in terms of losing power. You have to remember there is a military leader here, President Musharraf, with power in a coup. There is no open, strong opposition to him. But, of course, it is very worrying to the authorities here. It's a matter of pride to be able to say you can guarantee the safety of foreigners. And, in fact, there was 24-hour patrols outside the American consulate. But despite all that, these attacks are still happening. The Pakistanis appear to be unable to stop them, and they also seem to be unable to find those who were responsible. The only court case we've got going at the moment in relation to the three previous attacks on foreigners are the people who are up for trial in connection with Daniel Pearl's abduction and murder. They seem to have got nowhere in investigating last month's suicide attack in which 11 French nationals were killed, and I think that is a matter for grave concern here.
The United States has closed its embassy in Islamabad today and all its consulates in Pakistan. Is there a sense that foreigners may be abandoning Pakistan from fear?
Well, they have been doing this for a few months now. I mean, really, the first indications were after the attack on the church in Islamabad, in which an American diplomat's wife and daughter were killed. After that incident, a lot of American embassy staff and their family left. We then had the suicide bombing last month, which caused another exodus. The British said that they had heard about specific threats against foreigners, and they've evacuated a lot of their staff, as have many other Western embassies. The whole crisis between India and Pakistan has also led to many people leaving. The UN has been sending out the families of its staff. So there aren't that many foreigners left here. The Americans and the British have said their nationals should leave Pakistan unless they have essential work to do here. So it's hard to see how much stronger the warning could really be from the Western government.
Immediately after 9/11, we were all told that Pakistan's government was divided, that some elements of the government were sympathetic with the Islamists. Do you have a sense today that Pakistan's government is united in opposing this kind of terrorism, or are there still divisions?
Well, obviously there will be some elements within the army and within the intelligence services who do support the militants. It was a long-standing policy of Pakistan's, after all, and they basically founded the Taliban, for example, and they had supported the Kashmiri militants. So it's very hard to change that policy overnight. What President Musharraf has succeeded in doing is sidelining a lot of those people who are thought to have pro-Islamist tendencies, particularly within the army. I think it's felt the intelligence agencies are falling into line. So although there are certain areas where you may hear there are possible dissent, we're not seeing any open signs of that. And it's thought generally that President Musharraf will take the army and the intelligence services with him.
Susanna Price, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Susanna Price is a reporter with the BBC. She spoke to us from Karachi, Pakistan. Last month, President Bush signed a new $190 billion farm bill that increases already large subsidies to American farmers. Subsidies produce a glut of corn, wheat, and rice on the world market that drives down global crop prices. First world farmers are protected by subsidies. Third world farmers and those who depend on them are not. A debate is raging over the relationship between first world subsidies and third world poverty and hunger. What responsibility do the U.S., Europe, and Japan bear for the hunger crisis in the third world? And what responsibility does the U.S. have to lead in finding a solution? Do Africans have to die for Kansas farmers to prosper? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Ames, Iowa, is Neil Harl. He's director of the Center for International Agricultural Finance at Iowa State University. Good evening and welcome, Neil Harl.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Thanks for being with us.
Yes, indeed.
Neil, at the top level, what is going on here? We just came back, I guess people did, from the UN World Summit in Rome on hunger. The cries from the third world are very loud. The summit broke up in a lot of acrimony. People are starving. There's a lot of hunger. If we produce more than enough food to feed the world, why are people still going hungry?
Well, there are three reasons, in my view. The three are income, income, and income. The U.S. and the other food-exporting countries are prepared to feed the world, at least as much of the world as can afford to be fed. And we have basically a market economy in food worldwide, except for some food provided on a humanitarian basis.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're really serious about solving the world hunger problem, and I genuinely believe that next to terrorism, it's the ranking problem that the globe faces.
And Italian Prime Minister Berlusconi said the same thing at the meeting. He said terrorism and world hunger, these are the top, maybe they share the top place for world priorities.
And hungry people are among the more mischievous long-term countries that are deprived of food, live in poverty, are places we really ought to be concerned about. If our concern is our own security, mm-hmm. it's important for us to be working diligently. I think that the high road here is to do what we can to support third world economic development. And ironically, this would be in the best interests of U.S. farmers and other farmers in exporting countries. In those third world countries of the that have the poorer layers of citizens, the amount of additional income that goes for food is very high, in some cases high as 75 cents out of every dollar expressed in dollar terms. In this country, that figure is like 20 cents. So there is an immense potential for increasing the demand for food. In fact, the last frontier for increasing the demand for food worldwide is the third world.
But as it stands today, the first world countries, and because of the recent $190 billion subsidy, I guess, the United States in particular lately, is under fire for the subsidies that they make to their own farmers. How do subsidies to farmers in Iowa, or Illinois, Kansas, somehow filter through to hurt farmers in Africa and other third world countries?
Let me take just a moment to go step by step, because understand this, you need to go step by step. First of all, agriculture in the United States has a very fortunate capacity to overproduce. The country's welfare would be much less if we were persistently running shortages.
Amen.
We have had unlimited production since 1996. That is producers producing flat out. Now, since we have a capacity to overproduce, that soon led after 1996. It took about a year and a half for this to surface, but it soon led to falling prices and falling farm incomes. And we learned something very profound, that Congress doesn't like economic pain, and economic pain of constituents trumps ideology every time. So by a greater margin than the 1996 Farm Bill passed, Congress started providing subsidies to prevent that economic pain from forcing a reduction in supply and essentially making up the lost income.
Protecting American farmers. But just at that first level, as you go through this step by step, why wouldn't falling prices, that is cheaper corn, wheat, rice, provide more cheap American food to the whole world?
Well, the problem is it drops the world price for those commodities.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that for a country that is prepared to match the United States, then the treasury of the country will make up the difference in income there. But for many of the third world countries in particular, and some that aren't third world countries, they're not prepared or able to do that. So there are economic adjustments then that occur as world price falls because of production in the United States and elsewhere.
So you're saying American farmers are protected from the falling prices by the subsidy, but third world farmers are not.
But they are not protected.
And the consequence of that is?
Consequence is, first of all, if there's any value in their land, they lose land value. But in many of the third world countries, there's really not a lot of value in the land, so it begins to affect the returns to labor and of the farmers. And so after a time, in the extreme, if there are options in employment off the farm, they go to those options. So it diminishes the capacity of the country to produce its food.
So U.S. subsidies, in effect, drive down global prices, which drives third world farmers off the land, which means falling production in those countries.
Which means falling production locally. Now, it also could mean that the U.S. market share could increase.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's really the intent behind all this. I really believe in watching this process that the Congress just hasn't thought that much about the potential impacts around the world. Now, it does lead to lower cost food, but from an economic development perspective, a lot of countries have made a large mistake in keeping their food price low for domestic political reasons, and that has hurt them in terms of their economic development. So the argument here has two sides to it, but very clearly. But my feeling is that we need to be sensitive to the impact of this on third world agriculture production, on third world economic development, and factor that to a degree into our decisions relative to the subsidy process in the United States.
And yet the sense in rural America is that without these subsidies, it would be American farmers being pushed off the land.
That's right, because these subsidies essentially flow through the farmer's pocket fairly quickly and flow into the pockets of the people who own the land, the landlords, and the equipment dealers and others in the local community, so that the farmer actually ends up retaining a relatively small part. It's essentially just replacing the income they should have gotten from the market, if you will, had they not had this rather artificial and somewhat economically distortive relationship where farm commodities are being sold consistently below the cost of production, with the taxpayers making up the difference.
We're talking about hunger and the global food market tonight, and the charge from the third world that subsidies in the United States, in Europe, and Japan are actually sinking third world farmers, are actually pushing third world residents into hunger, even starvation. What do you think? Are U.S. farm subsidies actually causing third world hunger? Would you be willing to pay more at the grocery store if that helped fight hunger and poverty abroad? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about American farm subsidies and their impact on agriculture in the developing world. We're joined by Neil Harrell. He's director of the Center for International Agricultural Finance at Iowa State University. You're welcome to join us as well. Are U.S. farm subsidies actually causing third world hunger? And would you be willing to pay a little more at the grocery store if that helped fight hunger and poverty abroad? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Professor Harrell, if you would stand by for just a minute, earlier today I spoke with Alan Larson. He's Undersecretary of State for Economic, Business, and Agricultural Affairs in the U.S. Department of State. He was in Rome for this week's U.N. Summit on Hunger. I asked him if subsidies to first world agriculture cause problems, including hunger, in the third world.
I think they contribute to problems, but I think it's going too far to say they cause hunger. The United States has taken a very strong position against hunger. We are launching initiatives to promote stronger agriculture in some of the poorest countries. We are the largest provider of humanitarian food assistance. And we have been the country that has been among those that's fought the strongest to eliminate the agricultural export subsidies that we believe are the most distorting of the marketplace and hurt poor farmers the most.
But we're told by the UN Director General of the UN Food and Agricultural Organization that first world countries spend $1 billion a day on subsidies. That creates huge stockpiles of food that ends up driving down commodity prices globally and hurting third world farmers. What do you think of that analysis?
When we look at the subsidies that are practiced in Europe and Japan, they are much larger than those that the United States has. So one point is that to the extent there's a problem, it's a problem that's been created more by Japan and Europe than by the United States. But secondly, the United States does believe that it is appropriate for all of the trading countries working together to bring down these subsidies. We think American agriculture will benefit from that because we think that if there's a level playing field, we will do very well, particularly vis-a-vis the Europeans and the Japanese.
But aren't we moving the other way? It's just very recently that the U.S. signed, authorized a new $190 billion farm subsidy plan over the next 10 years, $83 billion more than lawmakers anticipated when they passed the 1996 big farm bill. Aren't we moving away from the level playing field and into deeper subsidies?
Our estimates are that the amount of spending that we would be doing over the next 5 years under the new farm legislation would be on a par with the spending of the last 3 years. So we do think that some of the criticism that the United States has received from other countries has been exaggerated, and we think that in particular the criticism is unwarranted when it's come from the Europeans, who are much bigger subsidizers than are we.
And what about when it comes from the third world and saying, hey, you United States, Europeans, all of you rich guys, we can't prosper and our agriculture can't hold its own if your subsidies drive down crop prices? Are you sympathetic to that?
What we are saying to the developing countries is that join with us in the World Trade Organization in a negotiation to bring these subsidies and market distortions down. The developing countries were among the strongest supporters of the American negotiating agenda for the WTO negotiations last year. And we made agricultural liberalization a high priority for the United States. And again, we are fortunate to be in the position where we can serve two interests with this. We do advance our commercial interests by being able to have freer trade in farming. And I think it gives developing country farmers a fair shake as well.
Can third world agricultural economies ultimately prosper if these subsidies, all the subsidies, stay in place?
they cannot prosper to the extent that they would if there were fewer subsidies. I think for many of the African countries where there has not been the improvement in agriculture that other parts of the world have seen in the last generation, there is an immediate task of making sure that basic food production, the sort of staple foods that people eat, that grows so that they can feed a growing population. And that's something that I think is largely independent, largely not affected by these international subsidies. But it's also true that for many of the poorer countries, agriculture is one of their necessary export sectors. We have an interest in seeing these countries succeed. The richer they get, frankly, the more we'll be able to sell to them, including the more agricultural products. As their income levels grow up, we'll be able to sell them more feed grains because they'll be able to increase their consumption of meat. And so I don't see it as a zero-sum issue. I think American farmers on the whole are among the world's most efficient. And I think if we can get to a more level playing field internationally, we will do fine and we'll create more opportunities for the developing country farmers as well.
Alan Larson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Alan Larson speaking with me earlier today. He's Undersecretary of State for Economic, Business, and Agricultural Affairs at the U.S. Department of State. He spoke with us from Washington. Neil Carl Harl, you heard his view of what's going on. Do you agree? Is the United States government pitching in to address world hunger aggressively? And is it unfair, as he said, to say that first world agricultural subsidies cause hunger in the third world?
I think the U.S. is working toward reducing world hunger. I just think we should be doing considerably more. Humanitarian food aid is certainly laudable, but humanitarian food aid, unfortunately, essentially demolishes the local agricultural sector. And so humanitarian food aid, while many of us feel an urge to support that when we have abject poverty and we have serious shortcomings in terms of food supply. Nonetheless, that is not a long-term plus. I think that the fact is we're not making much progress in reducing world hunger. We have not made a lot of progress since 1996. And what we're doing, I think, is laudable, but we've got to do more. I'm convinced that we need to pursue a global food and agriculture policy. About 80 years ago, the debate in this country was over whether there was room for a national food and agriculture policy, and the answer was no, all the way through the 1920s. And that didn't change until in the 1930s. Today, we accept that. In fact, this latest farm bill, 450 pages of legislation, is pretty good testimony in support of the fact that we do have a national food and agriculture policy. But we're at the point where we need to elevate our sights and start talking about a global food and agriculture policy and heading the list of about half a dozen or so components of that is support for third world economic development, because the real key here, in my view, is to raise the incomes. That was alluded to just a moment ago.
Yes, it was. But how do you get that kind of global food policy when you get such a kind of lukewarm apparent interest from first world countries? The meeting this week in Rome, there were 74 heads of state, only two from wealthy countries, Italy and Spain. Everybody else said we're busy.
That was discouraging. That is not a good sign. It, I think, indicates that eradication, elimination, reduction of world hunger levels is not as high a priority item as some of us believe that it should be. And so I think we need to look introspectively. What's important to us and what's important to the globe? I think this generation is capable of actually doing something about the world hunger and reducing it as the commitment was made in 1996.
And to Alan Larson's specific point, he said it's not fair to draw a link between first world agricultural subsidies and third world hunger. Do you agree or not?
I think what it does is prevent the third world countries from growing as rapidly as they should. So while it may not cause hunger, it is associated with inability of those countries to climb out of their low-income state, a low-caloric intake state. Those are the consequences. It's the fact that it keeps a level of pressure on those countries, as he noted correctly. Agricultural exports are one of the meaningful economic development opportunities for those countries. And you can imagine how that's going to fare when the world price is artificially depressed because of overproduction occurring in the agricultural exporting sides of the world.
And as we've seen, subsidies contribute to that. Listeners, we're talking tonight about hunger and the global food market. Not just a do-gooder view of this, but a structural view. What are the elements that keep the third world from feeding itself more effectively? And does it trace back to agricultural subsidies in the United States and other first world nations? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ron is on the line. Welcome, Ron. You're on the air.
Hi. Posed a question earlier in your show, would we be willing to pay higher food prices in the grocery store if that increased price could go toward fighting world hunger? And my answer to that would be yes, with a caveat. What assurance would we have that the extra money we're paying is actually going to go to the places where it's needed rather than going to the pockets of the bureaucrats who are supposedly administering the programs?
It's a great question, Ron. Thanks for calling in with it. Neil Harrell, I put that question kind of rhetorically, but if American agriculture was not so subsidized, might we not have more expensive food in this country? And does that have to be part of a future in which subsidies are not pinching third world farmers?
I think we could see modestly higher food prices without the subsidies, because the market would eventually function here so that there would be an oscillation of commodity prices around the cost of production instead of staying perennially below the cost of production. But one of the important points there is that the farm gate portion of the retail food dollar is pretty modest, depending on the state of processing of the foods, as low as 5% for breads and highly processed foods. And
so it goes to middlemen and processors, you're saying?
Yes, that's right. So you could double the price of commodities, and it shouldn't have a huge impact on the retail price, but it often does because everybody else ratchets their percentage up as well. But I think the important point of that call is that there is a willingness, I think, that exceeds the leadership of the countries to be supportive of efforts that would genuinely and with assurance be directed at solving the world hunger problem. And I think that's the challenge, is to get governments to be more aggressive, to be out in front with respect to this issue. And I'm convinced, watching this for many decades, that there is support for that. I think people have a deep feeling about world hunger, and I think they realize that it's destabilizing in the world today.
A willingness, as you say, that exceeds the initiative we're seeing from leaders. Neil Harrell, stand by. I want to welcome into this conversation Irungu Houghton. He's a policy advisor at ActionAid USA. He's worked with ActionAid Kenya, and I think, good evening and welcome, Irungu Houghton. Thanks for being with us.
Good evening, listen.
I think you've also worked recently on a report done on agriculture in Malawi. Is that correct?
It is. We launched the research that had been done into the Malawi crisis. As some of the listeners may be aware, in the last 6 months, over 1,000 Malawians have died a death of starvation as a result of the collapse of the agriculture sector.
So here's a good case in point. Your report's entitled Death by Starvation in Malawi, the Link Between Macroeconomic and Structural Policies and the Agricultural Disaster in Malawi. And we dug into this, and I see an awful lot here in the way you describe exactly what happens that does not seem so related to global policy. You're talking about declining soil fertility, restricted access to agricultural inputs, erosion of social capital, HIV/AIDS, neglect at the policy level of the smallholder agriculture sector. I guess my question, Irungu Houghton, to you is, what portion of responsibility for these problems with hunger and third world agricultural production lies with the third world, and what portion with first world policy?
I mean, I think it's difficult to present this in terms of any percentage of blame, but I would like to quote President Museveni at the end of the World Social Summit, where he said that we should stop beating around the bush. The most fundamental problems are not the weather and not the lack of improved seeds, but essentially are to do with world trade rules that prescribe a certain amount of sanctions on one set or one set of countries and allows another set of countries to go scot-free. And this really links back to the discussion that's taken place so far about the way in which protectionism in the North is just not permitted or allowed, nor is the space allowed for African countries to design their own agricultural policy.
So are you saying we're really focusing on subsidies tonight? If first world subsidies were dropped, do you believe that would filter through to more effective agriculture in the third world and better fed third worlders?
No, I think the important thing is not to see the South as the object of northern produce, but essentially to look at what's happening in those countries themselves. In the case of Malawi, it's very clear that the last 10 years of structure adjustment programs has led to the dismantling of government departments that were responsible for regulating the sale of the produce production and sale of maize, the staple diet.
Structural adjustment, I presume that means some World Bank hand.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the most important institution at the moment has been the International Monetary Fund. And through a mix of conditionality and advice, the IMF has advised the Malawian government to dismantle parastatals, the government departments, to eliminate all tariffs and price controls within the economy.
And you've seen a negative impact from that. I want to get a call in before the break. Jay is on the line. Welcome, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for my for taking my call. I sense that the discussions and the arguments being made are being made by people who see the world through their particular filters. Mm-hmm. When you see the world, the problems in those countries is an agricultural problem, the solution is an agricultural solution. But if you compare this to some other industries, like, for example, the chip dumping by the Asians into the U.S.,
okay.
What we find in the U.S. is we say, well, we howl about it, but in the end we buy the chips cheap, and we utilize the cheap cost of chips to drive down prices here. We create good products and infrastructure and distribution of those things. Shouldn't we look at the problem over in the third world of starving countries as more of a problem of outside the agricultural industry? And do we need to work on the distribution systems? Do we need to work on eliminating the corruption that keeps the appropriate, inexpensive agriculture coming from the first world countries into the map of the third world countries?
Okay, Jay, your phone's breaking up, but we've got your premise. I want to put it to Neil Harl. How about it? What do you say we just open the floodgates, put this super productive U.S. agricultural sector to work, and feed the world right out of the Great Plains?
Well, if all countries were prepared in terms of productivity of their people, in terms of education and health care and investment in infrastructure, then I think that type of an approach would have merit. The problem is that the one sector that many of those countries have to generate export earnings, to use to move down the path toward higher levels of economic development, is basically their agriculture. And they don't really have the same kind of options that the U.S. would have.
So if they can't make money farming, they may not have any options.
That's often the case. And so, and that's precisely why I think that we need policies in place that will encourage investment in those countries, and it may be coming totally from outside those countries for a time, but we got some good track records here. South Korea was a basket case after the Korean War. They started developing their agriculture. It wasn't going very well, so they shifted their policy to an industrial policy, and they moved into the development queue that is now embracing much of the Pacific Rim, so that they produce labor-intensive products, sell to the rest of the world, and buy their food, and they're about our fourth biggest customer now.
So maybe it's possible in some cases to skip the pattern of history, rely for your food on someone else, and make chips. We're talking about hunger and the global food market, how first world subsidies figure in. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We will be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about hunger and the global food market, about the impact of first world agricultural subsidies on third world agriculture. The food may be nice and cheap at the neighborhood supermarket, but what is the impact of that in the Congo, in Sudan, in Malawi? We're joined tonight by Neil Harl. He's director of the Center for International Agricultural Finance at Iowa State University, and by Irungu Houghton. He's policy advisor at ActionAid USA. Irungu Houghton, you heard just before the break, a caller suggested, why don't we just open the floodgates, let American grains and foods feed the world if we can do it so well? Why not just let it roll? Neil Harl says, in some cases, countries can kind of sidestep the agricultural step in their economic development, like South Korea, go straight to computer chips, let's say. You've just been in Malawi. If Malawi doesn't develop its agricultural sector, can it move right on to something else, answering phones for American insurance companies? Or is there something else to step in the breach as a rung on the economic ladder?
Well, in the case of Malawi, they have been looking at diversifying into manufacturing and into various other sectors. But I think the most interesting example that was given recently is the global coffee industry. It is worth $55 billion U.S. Dollars. And in the last year or so, producing countries only managed to realize about $8 billion of that $55 billion. Mm. And that really is to do with the extent to which Africa, Asia, and Latin America continue largely to produce raw goods for processing in the north. President Museveni has gone on record as having tried to persuade Nestle to produce to set up a company or a factory in Kampala, and they have refused. And his point essentially is that why should Uganda, as the fourth largest producer of coffee, and having doubled its output over the last 15 years, why is it that they and other producing countries are not realizing more of the profits from that sector?
But interestingly, we're still talking there about processing related to agriculture. Benjamin is on the line. Welcome, Benjamin. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you very much, Sam. And the point I'm trying to make is the problem of Africa is not just a matter of subsidy or whether the United States is holding Africa down or not.
Okay.
I don't think that's the case. The problem is that Africa, they look down on farming. People look down on people that go into farming.
They look down on farmers as a low-class occupation?
There is no incentive by the government to promote farming industry. As a result, you have people who are willing to walk around hungry with ties and suits rather than going to the farm.
There's an image. Benjamin, our time is short, so I'll thank you for it. But Neil Harl, how about it? Is maybe we're barking up the wrong tree here. Benjamin says there's a cultural problem in Africa. Only the folks at the bottom of the totem pole are willing to be farmers at all.
Well, we have seen that. Yes, some evidence of that. I think in part, many of the countries in Africa have kept their food prices low, and there hasn't been a great deal of economic incentive in terms of the growth potential in the agricultural sector. But I think if their agriculture were more profitable, I think this would perhaps change that to a degree. The problem is basically productivity of the labor supply. There are numerous countries in the Pacific Rim in particular where they have progressively moved higher and higher on the development ladder because they were able to offer employers, fairly productive labor, low-cost labor,
mm-hmm.
and the problem in Africa is the productivity of the labor, and it's going to take investment in education and health care, in governance, because part of the problem in Africa in some areas is still the governance issue.
So for right now, they may not have an option other than agriculture. Let's get one more quick call. Brian is on the line. Welcome, Brian. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a simple question. It seems that this all stems from overproduction
yes.
driving the prices down.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we just cut back on production? Is it a fear that the Americans won't pay the higher price?
Good question. Let me put it straight to Neil Harl. Neil, why don't we just cut production?
Well, we did from 1938 to 1996. The Secretary of Agriculture was the surrogate CEO of the sector and did what other CEOs do when they have excess inventories. We had grain reserves, and the Secretary would open up the grain reserves, and some of the grain would flow into storage to be used in times of short crops and to idle land to keep a reasonable balance in demand and supply.
Did it work?
That was all. Well, I think it worked better than we give it credit for today. It was all swept away. Those authorities were all swept away in a brief period of euphoria because commodity prices spiked up. Corn, for example, hit $5.54.5 a bushel on the Scroger Board of Trade July 12, 1996, and that was unprecedented. And farmers began to believe, and people in Congress, gee, we may not need these policies that are focusing on balancing, attempting to balance demand and supply. I think we may eventually return to a more rational version of that, and I think we need a benefit-cost analysis that takes a look, close look, at the impacts of our farm policy, not just on U.S. farmers and U.S. farm communities and the environment and on taxpayers, but also the global impact as well. And I think that is overdue. I think it's something that we should be focusing on between now and 2007 when we're going to take another look at farm policy. This bill will run through the year, crop year 2007.
Which, to your point, means we can't just make national farm policy in a vacuum anymore. And with that, we are out of time. Neil Harl, I want to thank you for coming on tonight.
It's been a great pleasure.
Neil Harl is director of the Center for International Agricultural Finance at Iowa State University. And Irungu Houghton, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Irungu Houghton is a policy advisor at ActionAid USA. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, Gambia scores high, Singapore so-so, and Fiji fails, grading the world's flags on Flag Day. This is On Point. A country's flag is its symbolic overture to the world. The color red might stand for the blood of battle, yellow for the rising sun, green for great grasslands. When working on his PhD dissertation, Josh Parsons found himself constantly looking for distractions, so he and his friends created a website that graded flags of the world. And these self-appointed flag judges were tough. For Flag Day, Josh spoke to us about which countries passed and which didn't.
Well, it took me a while to get to having some standards. At first, I just looked through a bunch of flags and thought about which I thought were good and which were bad and which were just really silly. I started to realize that there are some common mistakes that people make when they're designing flags. The most obvious thing that's a good thing about a flag is it should be simple and it should be iconic. They should be quick to recognize, but they also need to be aesthetically appealing. And then I guess the third important criterion is that they've got to be original and be something that can be associated with the country that's new, that's distinct from the name of the country and the shape of the country and other things that are already associated with the country. Gambia is a good case because it's very simple. It's a modified tricolor. And it uses very nice colors, and there's not too many of them. And it also says something about the country in a very clever and symbolic way. Gambia is almost entirely contained inside Senegal. And the reason for that is that British gunboats used to be able to drive up and down the River Gambia. And so the borders of the Gambia are the distance a British gunboat could fire a cannonball into French-held Senegal. And that's displayed on the flag of Gambia, which shows the river in the middle and the two banks on either side. But at the same time, it's very iconic and very pleasing colors. There were some Fs awarded. I gave an F to the flag of Guam, for example, which I have a little bit of a soft spot for. When I was initially making these decisions about the flags, I showed them to some of my friends, and one of my friends said, well, some flags are really just, you'd rather be using a tea towel. And the flag of Guam would actually make quite a nice tea towel, but it doesn't make a very good flag. It's blue, and it's got a little picture in the middle of a palm tree and a little beach. And just to cap matters off, it's got the name of the country written on it as well in big letters. There are two things that are wrong with writing on a flag. First of all, writing isn't iconic. It's just the wrong kind of thing to do on a flag. But it's especially bad if you write things like the name of the country on the flag, because the name of the country is already associated with the country. You don't need to look on the flag to remind yourself what the name of the country is. The other thing that people like to write on flags is little slogans, as in the case of a lot of the flags of former colonies of the UK have little Latin tags on them. And I rather think this is because the Home Office civil servants like showing off how good their Etonian education is. But the really worst ones are the ones where the civil servant responsible had no Etonian education and wrote something in English on the flag, like on the flag of the Falkland Islands. It says, desire the right on the flag. countries have a real hard time coming up with ideas for what to put on their flag, and sometimes it occurs to them to put the map of the country on the flag, as Cyprus do. And not only do they put a map of the country on the flag, they put it in horrible colors as well, in yellow on white. Why do you need to have a map on the flag when you could just look in an atlas if you wanted a map of the country? Tuvalu nearly fooled me. They actually have a map of their country on their flag, but it looks like a bunch of stars. But for a while, I didn't realize the stars on the flag of Tuvalu are actually in the shape of the islands that make up Tuvalu. One of the serious environmental problems facing Tuvalu is the highest point on Tuvalu is about 10 meters above sea level. So in the case of global warming, a lot of Tuvalu would be underwater, which is very unfortunate since they've put a map of Tuvalu showing where their islands are on their flag. So if it went underwater, the flag would be inaccurate. Mostly, I kind of like stars on a flag. They're iconic. There are lots of ways that people can use them. Vietnam has a classic use of stars. A lot of Islamic countries use the star and crescent. These are very good iconic designs. But a lot of countries seem to think that if one star is good, then 50 must be just right, like the flag of the U.S. Interestingly, there are a lot of flags that are a bit like the flag of the U.S. that have probably plagiarized it, that do it rather better, like the flag of Cuba and the flag of Puerto Rico. I realized as I went that they vary in terms of whether they've used good colors for the flag or not. I mean, some countries have special colors associated with them which they have to use, and other countries get to choose what colors they're going to use, and sometimes they choose very poorly. It really hurts to look at these flags. Another thing that can go wrong is countries might use a lot of colors that aren't really bad, but just too many of them, or kind of too many areas of clashing colors. Central African Republic, for example, has a lot of different colored rectangles. It looks like a Kandinsky painting or something. Four stripes. It's got blue, white, green, and yellow, and then it has a big red stripe down the middle, dividing the flag into two zones. And then it has a little yellow star on top of the blue part of the flag. I really think that's too much. It's just eye-wrenching. It's like they've tried to disprove the four-color theorem on their flag or something like that. Putting pictures of weapons on flags, I think, is a particularly bad special case of putting pictures of anything on flags. As I keep saying, they should be iconic, and they shouldn't have representational art on them. But it's one thing to go putting a maple leaf or something on your flag, and another thing to put pictures of the weapons that you're using to conduct a bloody repression of your citizens on it, like the flag of Mozambique, which actually has a picture of an AK-47 on it. Besides an AK-47, Mozambique also has a picture of a hoe and a book and a star, and this is all on top of a coloured design. It really does look as though it's been designed by a committee that all of the members of which had bright ideas. Hey, let's have an AK-47 on our flag. No, let's have a star. And then they just couldn't decide and put them all on the flag.
Today, Josh Parsons works as a research fellow in the philosophy department of St. Andrews University in Scotland. To find his complete listing of flags and grades, go to our website at onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Heath Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help tonight from John Hoder. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.